Davis was incensed over the article. Eisner barely knew Davis, but he was a type of executive that Eisner had never confronted directly before. Davis took aim at anyone beneath him whose success seemed to pose any threat to his hold on power. He had long toiled in the shadows of Charles Bluedorn, who had built Gulf and Western from an obscure sugar manufacturer into a force in mining, publishing, Simon & Schuster, and entertainment. Davis was brusque, unpolished, and often vulgar. He had a finance background and had little understanding of or respect for the creative process. After Bluedorn suffered a fatal heart attack in his home in the Dominican Republic in 1983, Davis succeeded him. From his office atop the Gulf and Western building in New York, Davis badgered Diller to get rid of Eisner. Davis also resented the attention that Katzenberg had garnered in the magazine. On a visit to New York, Katzenberg stopped in to meet Davis for the first time since he'd become chairman of Gulf and Western. Instead of the praise Katzenberg expected, Davis ventilated his hostility toward his Hollywood executives. "You're all overpaid and spoiled," he said. He told Katzenberg he was a little Sammy Glick. And after Katzenberg reported the bizarre encounter to Eisner, Eisner confronted Diller and demanded to know what was going on. Weary of the subterfuge he'd been maintaining, Diller told Eisner that Davis wanted him to fire Eisner. It was hard to believe, given Paramount's success. "Marty's an idiot, but it's true," Diller said. Eisner talked to Katzenberg about forming a business partnership to produce movies and television, and the two even worked up a business plan. After years of working in Eisner's shadow, Katzenberg was thrilled that his mentor held him in such high regard. "Don't worry," Eisner told him. "Whatever happens, we're partners for life." Several other possibilities were floating around. A move to CBS or Capital Cities ABC, for example. But moving back to television didn't excite Eisner. He and Ovitz strategized about a buyout of American International Pictures, which Eisner wanted to rename Hollywood Pictures. And then, while visiting his sons at Camp Key Waden in August 1984, Eisner learned of Roy Disney's resignation from the Disney board and called him. "Are you still interested in coming to Disney?" Roy asked when he returned Eisner's call. During the 1980s, the era of swashbuckling corporate raiders, Roy E. Disney seemed like the last person to lead a boardroom coup or hostile takeover. Somewhat quiet and shy by nature, with a wry sense of humor, Roy rarely spoke at Disney board meetings. He and Eisner served together on the board of the California Institute of the Arts, a school founded and endowed by Walt and Roy O., Walt's brother and Roy E.'s father. In those meetings, Eisner never heard Roy say a word. Though he bore a strong family resemblance to his uncle Walt and was the only male heir in the family, Roy had long ago been pushed aside in the Disney hierarchy in favor of Ron Miller, the handsome ex-football star who married Walt's daughter Diane. But Roy's gentle demeanor masked other qualities he'd inherited from his Disney ancestors: determination, persistence, and a strong, even stubborn will. After their respective marriages, both Walt and his brother Roy had been slow to conceive children. There was rejoicing in the two families when Roy Edward was born to Roy and Edna in 1930. It is a somewhat confusing tradition in the Disney family to name sons after their fathers, but to choose a middle name that begins with their mother's initial, in this case,